It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As we've heard in the news, a grand jury announced their decision not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for shooting and killing unarmed black teen Michael Brown. Coming up, a professor of race relations discusses the national implications of the decision and how the country moves forward from here.
First, Governor Scott Walker has been talking to the national news media about a potential run for president. While he hasn't thrown his hat into the ring just yet, he suggested that he is open to the concept, but that could be a tall order trying to do the job of a governor while campaigning in early primary states and beyond.
Our next guest laid out that challenge in a piece this week. We welcome back Jason Stein, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's co-author with his colleague Patrick Marley of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what leaps to mind is being governor, a full-time gig, but in a lot of ways, so is running for president, isn't it?
Right. I would say those are both more than full-time gigs.
So let's start with Governor Walker before we turn to candidate Walker. What kind of things would the governor have to do here in Wisconsin leading up to 2016?
Sure. Well, his immediate task is to find, look over his cabinet, see where he wants to make changes, see where people on his cabinet want to leave, replace those people. At the same time, he's preparing his budget bill that he'll submit in late January or early, mid-February. That, is a document that contains, 60-some billion dollars in state and federal money and spending. It won't be an easy budget. It won't necessarily be a terrifically hard budget in terms of the financial crunch, but it will not be an easy one. There is a shortfall right now being projected. So he'll have to put that together. And all that will take us through, May or June of next year. And then, then will come a whole slew of legislative proposals. So, there'll be a lot going on, particularly over the next 6 months in state government.
And are these things that national Republican bigwigs and maybe early primary voters might watch for signals about what kind of candidate, what kind of president Scott Walker would be?
I think so. I mean, sure. I mean, I think the signature for a Scott Walker presidential campaign is always going to be the way in which he balanced the budget 3 years ago, and which included, repeal of most collective bargaining for most public employees. But there will be, he's talked about wanting to get the budget done quickly to hold up the Republican-controlled state government in Wisconsin as a contrast to the federal government, where obviously we have split control between the parties. And, he's talked about cutting taxes. He's talked about fixing the problems in the state transportation fund. Again, all of those are going to be certainly not probably as challenging as the budget he faced when he came into office, but nevertheless, it won't be a cakewalk either. So,
turning to candidate Walker, if he should run, Iowa, the caucus there, a big opportunity/obstacle for primary candidates. How important is it for a Scott Walker presidential campaign to do well in Iowa?
I think it would be essential because for a couple reasons. One, I mean, he will not necessarily have unlimited financial resources. He certainly does not have the name ID necessarily that say a Paul Ryan would have nationwide, just simply because Paul Ryan was on the ticket. Our congressman from Janesville was the vice presidential candidate in 2012. So, it's essential that if you're someone like Scott Walker, you don't have the name ID of someone like Hillary Clinton, that you get yourself in front of voters in some of those other primary states. Iowa, obviously a neighboring state to Wisconsin. Scott Walker spent some time growing up there, has kind of a common Midwestern values and outlook. So, you know, when you compare it to South Carolina or New Hampshire or one of the, you know, some of the other early states, it's probably the one where he'd have the best chance to do well. It would be easiest for him to physically campaign there as opposed to some of the other early primary states. So, you know, if he were to run and to make a poor showing in Iowa, I think it would be very difficult for him to continue. On the other hand, if he made a strong showing, that might give him something to build on in some of those later states.
And you talk to a lot of Iowa political pros, some longtime observers and people involved in politics in both parties in Iowa. What does it take to make that solid showing in the Iowa caucus?
Right. So what we were told in reporting the story is that you have to remember that this is a caucus state, not a primary. So there are a lot of conventions to selecting a presidential nominee in Iowa that it would be very strange to people in Wisconsin that only know the primary system. And the kind of the nature of a caucus means that you have to have more foot soldiers, you have to have more staff and volunteers to help you, you know, get yourself out there as a candidate. And to do that, you need to start organizing fairly early. So if what we were told is that by, you know, the beginning of next summer, late spring, early summer, Scott Walker or any other presidential candidate would need to have a team in place on the ground in Iowa. And to do that, you know, obviously he'd have to be working on that at some level at the same time that the state is putting together its budget.
Is this a thing where maybe you can make up for a lack of that ground game you're talking about with a massive ad campaign, put your money into TV
right.
and radio?
I mean, obviously that always helps. But what people in Iowa told me is that no, you can't have this as an air war, so to speak. You have to have a ground campaign as well. I mean, you know, to just give you one example of the what would seem like to us maybe sort of goofy rules of a caucus system, when you show up to vote in the evening in the wintertime, you have to have people get out there during a limited couple-hour window. You know, there's no early voting. There's no voting in the morning. There's no voting on your lunch hour from work. You've got to go out in the evening, and then, you know, you'll be in this room, in this community, you know, building a church or school or something. And supporters, say, of a Scott Walker or Chris Christie or Rand Paul or whoever ends up running can then stand up and give speeches. So, you know, some local community leader from your community in Iowa might stand up and say, well, I'm going to vote for Marco Rubio because of X, Y, or Z. And so, you know, there are these quirky elements of the caucus system that makes having a team of your own there very important.
This sounds time-consuming, and it sounds like it might be an advantage to be politically unemployed, to not be the governor of a state while you're running for president. That might have been an advantage for, say, Mitt Romney last time around.
Right. I mean, it's clearly an advantage for anyone running for president, you know, be it a primary or caucus state where they're competing, to just be able to devote themselves to that all-consuming task. And obviously, if you are not if you are employed, you do have a job serving the public. The next best thing would, in some ways, to be in Congress, because there, you know, you have to show up and do votes. But you're not a governor. You're not responsible for 60 or 70,000 full-time state employees. You're not solely responsible for putting together that budget of tens of billions of dollars. So, you know, you have a little more flexibility in your schedule. You know, the flip side of that is that you have the low approval ratings that come with Congress. But again, it can be done. I mean, you know, obviously mm-hmm. George Bush was governor of Texas. He ran for president and he did make it to the White House. But that being said, it's not an easy task to do to be a sitting governor and a presidential candidate.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us as always.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new documentary that explores why people call telephone hotlines for help, advice, and human connections.
First, more coverage of the grand jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri. Last night, the grand jury announced their decision not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson on 5 different counts. Wilson shot and killed the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown back in August.
We're taking your calls now. What do you think about the grand jury's decision? What was your immediate reaction when you heard? And what do you think about the relationship between the police and minority communities? How would you like to see the country move forward after this news? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
President Obama addressed the nation last night after the jury's decision was announced. Here's what he had to say.
We need to recognize that this is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America. We have made enormous progress in race relations over the course of the past several decades. I have witnessed that in my own life, and to deny that progress, I think, is to deny America's capacity for change. But what is also true is that there are still problems, and communities of color aren't just making these problems up.
Here to talk about the jury's decision and the nationwide implications is Chad Dion Lassiter. He's a professor of race relations and the president of Black Men at the Penn School of Social Work at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, and good evening.
Well, we just heard President Obama's words to the nation last night after the grand jury's decision not to indict was announced. How would you say that he did? Did he strike the right tone in a tough moment for everyone last night?
I think the president could have went a little bit farther, as he could have called for a national dialogue and conversation around policies and training, specifically anti-racism training within the police departments throughout America. I wasn't looking for the president to really take the lead on this, because he, for an extended period of time, has shown that he's either incapable of doing so or just doesn't want to do so. And so for me, I wasn't looking for anything. I wasn't sitting on the edge of my seat thinking that the president was going to bring together the effective coalition of humanity that's actually engaged in civil disobedience, not only in Ferguson, but all around the United States of America.
Now, what was your first reaction when you heard last night the news? We had to wait till about 9 o'clock to get it. No indictment. What did you think?
Out of the W.E.B. Du Bois school of thought, and that Du Bois stated that a system cannot fail those it was never built to protect. And so for me, I looked at it from a historical standpoint, that we've seen several cases like this where there doesn't seem to be justice levied appropriately when it's on the darker side of the color line. And so for me, I just continue to stay in the moment and encourage those young people that I was in contact with in Chicago, in Ferguson, in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., just to name a few places, to make this moment a movement and to engage in civil disobedience. And so I pretty much knew that there was not going to be an indictment based on the lack of transparency that was surrounding this case for an extended period of time and the cloudy evidence.
Now, there's a particular quote that's attributed to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that's been used quite a bit when people talk about Ferguson lately. It's riots are the language of the unheard. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what's happened in some of the civil disobedience in Ferguson? Maybe not riots, that may not be the word you use, but do you feel the black community doesn't feel heard?
I think it's been historical that the black community doesn't feel heard, and I would go a step further by saying that, in addition to King's quote, my colleague Michael B. Katz has a book entitled Why Don't American Cities Burn? And he talks about the structural inequality. He talks about the economic deprivation. He talks about the educational apartheid. And so, once again, we have to look at the fact that the violence is turned inward. There were no police officers shot or killed. Nor should we want any police officers shot and killed, just like we don't want police officers shooting unarmed black males. But we're talking about property destruction. The same things occurred when Martin Luther King was assassinated, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and finally Malcolm X were assassinated. It was property destruction. It wasn't the destruction of persons, and we don't want the destruction of persons, but we should also give that message to the police department, and that personhood and black humanity should not be seen as subhuman, but it should be seen as human.
Now, according to the statistics experts at the blog 538, grand juries do indict most of the time. So in that sense, the decision last night seems unusual. But on the other hand, use of reasonable force is reported to be a broad umbrella. What do you make of the decision not to send Darren Wilson to a criminal trial?
I think it should have been sent to a criminal trial. Once again, I think that it was an oversight and that the prosecutor failed to really present a coherent narrative to explain Wilson's actions. We can't deny that there was some sort of struggle. We can't deny that we need to do a drill down and really look at the transcripts of the testimony, the police reports, the autopsies, and the forensic evidence. But definitely, this whole entire system, for me, should have been indicted. From the judge to the prosecutor, this was gross negligence. A young man has been killed. Once again, we know that there was some sort of struggle. But once again, as we saw in the Trayvon Martin case, we're castigating the individual who's dead, and the person that's living, we're saying that they were the ones who fear for their lives. He had a gun. You know, we need to really work on excessive force and training in the communities around trust and mistrust of the police.
Now, St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney decided to release all the reports and testimony from the trial. Do you see this as a positive move towards transparency, as maybe a gesture of good faith? How do you see it?
Well, I think it's platitudes, and I think it's placating. I think it's taken too long. I think where we're at now is, you know, justice wasn't served, and so the Brown family has called for peace. The Brown family will have to decide what the next recourse is as it relates to them and their lawyers. Once again, this was botched. There are some reports that the prosecutor is 0 for 5 as it relates to, you know, prosecuting police officers who have either shot and or killed individuals. He didn't seem like he was in the role of prosecutor as he was talking last night. He seemed like he was in a role of just placating, ingratiating, and he was devoid of emotion for me the entire time that he spoke.
I want to get a caller or two in here before we go to the news. Joe joins us first from Oconomowoc. Hi, Joe.
Good evening. Yes, I could pick up the thread there. The grand jury process is always the prosecutor's show. Defense attorneys are never there. Many times the person who's the defendant doesn't speak or is not allowed to speak even. It's their show, and they work with police all the time in law enforcement. As a result, most grand juries do not indict police officers because it would be in, just not work well with the system that they work within. That's unfortunate. We've had that in Milwaukee a couple of times. What followed was the United States Justice Department through the United States Attorney's Office would conduct a separate investigation with the FBI. There would be a finding of violation of civil rights in the same incident and an indictment for criminal violation, conviction, and ultimately punishment of the officers. I'm expecting that that type of a process will occur here, but maybe not.
Thanks a lot for your thoughts, Joe. Joe, looking toward civil rights violation charges, which are reportedly tougher to prove, what would you say about Joe's, what his thoughts were there?
I think Joe's absolutely on point, and I would just echo the same words as Lisa Bloom. And Lisa Bloom said, I'm ashamed of my justice system, so good at protecting authorities and celebrities, so pathetically unable to give justice to African Americans. Self-defense, more often than not, will always work when it's the police officer. It does not mean that it's just the police. And that's why the before mentioned, the whole entire system needs to be indicted because it's a collaboration of the maintaining of the status quo with regards to the courts in conjunction with the police department. And so there cannot really be justice levied if we're looking at the fact that we're protecting and maintaining police even when they're engaged in police brutality and corruption.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Another quick call from Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I was furious about the lack of indictment, absolutely furious. I felt like throwing a book through my own wall. I'm 55 years old. I'm white. I live in a rural area, and I'm just as infuriated as you can possibly imagine. I was mad at the president. I thought what he said was patronizing to say that there's been no we can't deny there's been improvement in decades. My God, it's like a culture of lynching young black teenagers in inner cities in this country. I'm horrified. I'm absolutely horrified.
Elaine, thank you so much for calling and sharing your feelings at this moment. And Chad, what do you think about what Elaine said? A lot of anger at the presidents there and the culture that she sees.
I think Elaine is absolutely right, and I think that's one thing that WPR should be recommended, you guys should really just pat yourselves on the back in the sense that this is providing us a format to see that on every side of the color line, it just wasn't one-sided, that there are individuals all around the United States of America on varying sides of the color line and gender line who were also incensed, who also were enraged, who also displayed with anger and angst, and she's absolutely right. This is a president who placates, ingratiates, and displays with false generosity. This is a president who expects people to engage in a sense of nobility in the staggering face of violence and oppression.
We're talking right now with Chad Dion Lassiter, professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll be back to talk more with him and take more of your calls. And he's with us to talk about the grand jury's decision not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri earlier this year.
Call in now with your response, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue the conversation after the news on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter of the University of Pennsylvania about the grand jury's decision not to indict the police officer who shot and killed unarmed black teen Michael Brown earlier this year.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to that decision? What does it say about race relations in the U.S.? And how do you think the nation should move forward from here? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
To your calls in just a moment. First, a comment from Facebook from Mike. He said, keep in mind that the rage and anger are not just a response to the verdict. In this one case, generations of hatred, segregation, and racism leads to strong emotions. Chad, do we need to remember to put this decision into the big context of history and not just take a snapshot of last night?
We absolutely do. For every context, there's a pretext. And looking at the historical trajectory, we're looking at what happened in the 60s. We're looking at dogs, and we're looking at the Bloody Sunday. We're looking at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We're looking at water hoses. We're looking at freedom riders on the other side of the color line that lost their lives trying to fight for full humanity, leaving New York and going to Mississippi. We're looking at the integration of, you know, the Woolworth counters in the schools. And we're looking at Governor Wallace standing in front of the doorways. We're looking at the Little Rock, Arkansas 9. So we're looking at those four young ladies who died a superficial martyrdom death in Sunday school. And so it's bigger than looting and violence. They are killing black males with impunity.
I want to go back to our phones now. Tony joins us in Egg Harbor. Hi, Tony.
Good evening, Veronica and Chad. Thank you for the topic. I think the grand jury got it right, but let me preface that by saying I am the last person in the world that should be able to say that, because I'm not an attorney and I'm not in law enforcement. And I think the broader topic is the grand jury system is flawed because the deck is stacked against the defendant, and it's really in the favor of the state's attorney or the district attorney because he or she's the only one present pleading the case, and therefore they're not pleading the case, but they're laying out the case. And as a result of that, civilians, 90% of the time, are going to underscore what the DA or the SA bring to the table. And I think that the grand jury system, although it's important, should really be taken over by professionals who understand the law and know if this is a case that is achievably won in court. Your opinion?
Thank you, Tony, for your thoughts. Tony says he thinks the grand jury got it right, but that the system is not working the way he thinks it should. Chad, what kind of reform would you like to see, be it judicial or legal or social?
Well, for me, I think it needs to be social. It needs to be a more transparent process. For me to be on this call during this interview, trying to pretend I have a law expertise is something that I'm not going to do because it would be disingenuous to the process, and it really would just be just a gross negligence on my behalf. As a researcher and a social scientist, I can speak to the fact that we need to have civilian review boards that are monitoring some of these cases, if not the majority of these cases. We need to look at tactics like anti-racism training. We also need to dispel the myth that this is all police officers. This is not all police officers, but we also need to recognize that the pain and the anger is real. The pain and anger that you see is real, and that's why I keep going back to, you know, the president mentioning the looting and the violence, but not mentioning police brutality and white supremacy. And the fact that there is something that is happening in the psyche of some white male officers that they have to open up and just shoot black males unarmed to the degree that they do. Oscar Grant, Jordan Davis, Eric Gardner, Amadoula Diallo stands in his doorway with a wallet and he gets shot 41 times. What is it about that?
Now, protesters were angry last night, and people in Wisconsin and across the country, like Elaine, who we heard from earlier, angry at the decision. And there were signs from Ferguson and around the country that read, Black Lives Matter. That's a powerful statement. But how should the country and the police use those words to bring about change and positive action?
I think that police officers and police departments throughout the United States of America need to recognize the humanity of black and brown individuals, not to buy into the stereotypes and the myths that are deeply rooted in the culture of white supremacy. So when Darren Wilson argues that Mike Brown looked angry and he was coming at me looking like a demon, that's the racial polarization that a lot of the individuals have as it relates to black males being boogeymen, right? So we have to see their full humanity. We don't want to have these conflicts in the community. And so certainly there's some things on the community side that we need to be working on. And there are organizations that are working with black and Latino males around, you know, what to do when the police stop you. But the reality is you're getting killed like the 12-year-old did most recently with a toy gun. I mean, it's Elaine was absolutely right. It's 21st century lynching. And the president, he no longer can really speak to these issues because he's refused to be the bully in the pulpit.
Now, Michael Brown's family is advocating for the Michael Brown law, which would require police officers to wear cameras. That's something they'd like to see come out of this. What do you think about that proposed part of a solution?
I think it's a great solution because it's, once again, deeply rooted in the both, and it also protects the police officers. We cannot escape the fact that there have been some police officers in our country that have been killed as they were upholding and serving to protect humanity. And so by having these cameras, it will assist in the evidence. It will assist in, you know, some of the challenges that we see, not just in urban communities, but in our suburban communities as well as in our rural communities. And so I think this law is something that should be not just talked about, but we need to actually enact it. I think it's great, and it protects all stakeholders. It protects the police, it protects the individual, and it protects the community.
We're going to take another call here. Jim joins us in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I do bring a legal perspective. I've been a criminal trial attorney for 30 years. And there's an old joke, an accurate but bad one in my profession, that a good prosecutor should be able to indict a ham sandwich. What you had in this case objectively is an officer that fired and discharged his weapon 12 times. He didn't suffer any permanent injury. Also, procedurally, the prosecutor could have been charged and filed a criminal complaint without going to a grand jury. It was his decision, therefore discretionary, not to charge, and to put it in the grand jury process. Then one wonders, has to wonder the question that at least the urgency or the sense of professionalism of those who sought the indictment or who filed the request for an indictment as to what sort of enthusiasm they brought to their work under the facts and circumstances of this case. I like response, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you so much for your perspective, Jim, a legal perspective there. But, Chad, do you think there's something to take away from the grand jury moment and in different ways maybe going forward to look at cases like this?
I think that, you know, the caller was absolutely right. You know, was there any exuberance? Was there anything from the prosecutor to say that, you know, I want to make sure that this is fair and impartial? And I think that's why you're starting to get these comments that are starting to come in when a Reverend Al Sharpton says that the process, you know, itself should be indicted. You know, I think that people did not really feel as though the prosecutor was trying to prosecute Darren Wilson.
Now, when President Obama was elected, there started to be talk about living in a post-racial era. And as we've seen going forward, there have been things like Ferguson that come up and remind us that there's a lot of work to be done. What would you say about where we are right now as a country?
Well, post-racial is a mirage, and it still is a mirage. And I think that what we were so quick to do is we got excited because we had the first president of the United States of America who was a person of color. And you don't become post-racial because you say so. You have to roll up your sleeves and do the work of being tolerant, to get rid of the irrational hatred, to engage in having these frank conversations like we're doing today, to make sure that you don't engage in homophobic behavior, ethnocentrism, xenophobia, black victimization, because everything that happens in African-American communities is not a result of white supremacy, institutional racism. Where we are as a country is aspects of our country is fighting for black humanity, fighting for women reproductive rights, fighting for white humanity. I would be on your call right now if this was a black police officer shooting unarmed white males, because I see the humanity in individuals. As a country, there's another aspect of us that are really polarizing. You know, it's very quick for people to blame Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, my colleague Mark Lamont Hill, myself, and others as race baiters. That's not what we are. We're defenders of people who don't have a voice. At the present time, there's aspects of our country that's in denial about white supremacy and institutional racism, which is alive and well. Post-racial, you have to do the work to become post-racial, and we have to be committed to doing that work. And I'm not optimistic nor pessimistic, but I'm a prisoner of hope that we have enough people out here that are doing that with anti-racism training and not buying into their own victimization.
A lot of people echoing what you had to say, especially on Twitter last night. I think you've said this as well, that last night, though, people saying, teachers, throw out what you have on the curriculum for today. Talk about Ferguson for everybody. How can we use the situation as a teachable moment?
It is a teachable moment. From a mental health perspective, why was it that we were not, you know, deploying social workers, community interventionists, mental health workers, psychologists, and psychiatrists? We geared up for a paramilitary, terroristic, occupying force. We need to be looking at depression. We need to be looking at separation anxiety, abandonment, the second level of post-traumatic stress disorder for the family, for the friends of Michael Brown. And then also, I might get some flack for this, but also there has to be some form of trauma for those police officers, you know, out there on the front lines. I'm not being sympathetic or empathetic. I'm just bearing the truth. And so I think we need to be looking at all of these things in the schools. We definitely need to throw the curriculum out presently, but we also need to develop a curriculum that talks about irrational hatred, talks about, you know, seeing similarities in one another and not looking at people from a fair perspective. Art therapy, play therapy, music therapy, all these things from an age developmental perspective can aid in this moment that we can turn into a movement for all of humanity.
Chad, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, professor of race relations and president of Black Men at the Penn School of Social Work at the University of Pennsylvania. He was with us to talk about the grand jury's decision not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for shooting Michael Brown in August.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk about the situation in Ferguson and get a report on what happened during last night's protests.
First, our next guest wanted to explore the role that telephone hotlines play in today's society. Despite many people dismissing the telephone as a technology that's maybe on its way out, hotlines remain a popular outlet, with some reporting record high call volume these days.
But what motivates people to pick up the phones, dial a stranger, and pour their heart out? And just who are the strangers taking the calls? Filmmaker Tony Schaff wanted answers to those questions and wanted to start a conversation about how we deal with loneliness, isolation, and communication in an increasingly digital world.
Tony Schaff is the producer and director of the new documentary Hotline. He's also a former telephone psychic and suicide hotline volunteer. He joins us now. Tony, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Tony, why do hotlines like the ones we're talking about, everything from domestic abuse and suicide prevention hotlines to horoscopes, why are they so popular today?
Well, I think that, as you were saying, we are in an age where we're becoming more and more digitally isolated. I think people are willing to connect with each other through likes and shares on Facebook and Twitter. But picking up that phone and actually connecting with the people that are closest to you is becoming more and more rare.
Can you give us some examples about the common themes that would draw people maybe to call someone they don't know and share intimate things?
Well, I do believe that people are connecting in a time of need. They don't have people necessarily in their lives that they can say certain things to. It might be domestic abuse. It might be coming out as LGBT for the first time. Or, you know, just very simple things that we might take for granted.
Now, you go behind the scenes and talk to a lot of the people who provide these services, a wide variety of them. And what struck me, especially hearing people talk about, you know, mentioning coming out stories or suicide prevention, this seems to me like it would be an incredibly demanding, draining job. And for a lot of people, it's not a job. They're volunteers.
Yeah, it's very true. And we do explore that in the film. There is a bit of this vicarious trauma, I guess you would call it, by the volunteers or workers on hotlines. They really are taking on some of the most traumatic moments in these people's lives. We actually speak with 911 operators and people who work on these crisis hotlines, and it is such a demanding job. But what we also found was that people find this work so rewarding. It's them that are able to sort of provide a little solace in other people's lives. I'm sure that you probably understand quite well, working in radio, you're having to use the power of your voice to sort of to guide people through their days. And I'm sure people do turn to you and the power of your voices to make them feel a little bit better.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the people, not in radio, but the people you talk to in your documentary who are on the other side of the lines. What is the experience for them like being privy to someone's maybe darkest hour, most vulnerable moment, and then just hanging up and that's it? You never really hear the end of the story.
I think it does challenge these workers quite a bit. They are hearing something, and they might not know what the next moment will be. Some of the hotlines have a mantra of, you know, you never know. You never know what's going to happen next. You hope that the people will find help or will call back. But for the most part, these workers they don't hear from the people again. However, some of the people that I interview in the film have developed sort of long-term relationships. And I think that's another little interesting thing that happens with hotlines, is that these are intense and transient relationships. But some people will latch on, and it is intriguing, the connection that people might have over the telephone.
You know, if you've got a problem in this world, you could read about it. You can go online and maybe find some kind of help. You can email someone. A common theme I keep seeing in your documentary, though, is there's something about talking, and something about the power of talking and being heard and somebody talking back to you. What is it? What is it that makes that difference?
Yeah, some of our operators have sort of described it as like a sixth sense. Sometimes, you know, even just silence, just sharing silence with someone is powerful. And I think that there is a tone, there is a way in which we use our words, and that can provide information that the written word just that can't provide. It's a little bit of a mystery. It's a little bit of magic, I think, that happens over these hotlines.
Now, you profile a guy whose name escapes me now, who just puts his number out there and says, "Lonely guy, call me." And he kind of goes viral. And he's at one point stays on the phone, I think, for 17 hours. Can you talk about him and what drives him, what it's like to be someone like that?
Yeah, most definitely. His name is actually Jeff One Lonely Guy. And he was here in New York City, and he posted a flyer that said, "If anyone wants to talk about anything, call me." And he put his phone number up. Put a picture, someone took a picture of it, put it up on the internet, it went viral, and he just got nonstop calls. I think initially he was lonely and he was looking for someone to connect with, but what he found were there were so many other people that also just needed to talk to somebody. His story is very unique. I think that he's definitely one of those people as well that he just realized that it was much bigger than him, and he wanted to help other people. His phone number is still active, and people can still call him. I think that we sort of reached him at the point of filming the documentary, where he was at a breaking point. He possibly had taken on too much, and he was hoping that maybe this would inspire other people to start reaching out and helping each other.
Now, with that story, and you also profile, you mentioned an LGBT call center where they talked about they were getting flooded with calls after they put their toll-free number up before they had advertised it at all. People just calling 800-INFORMATION. Why is there so much demand to be talked to and listened to?
Yeah, you know, I really do think that it is this idea that other people, you know, just aren't, people don't feel that they're available, or they don't want to burden the people closest to them with their issues. Sometimes it is just the stranger, this idea of someone who's not going to be judgmental, someone who's not going to put their own beliefs on you. It's just someone that you can share a moment with, someone that may provide advice, but really is just there to listen and isn't there to tell you what you should be doing in the next moment.
What about someone like a Miss Cleo? People might remember her from back in the 90s. She had a late-night TV show. You get to know her, and she's ultimately a pretty different person than she is on television. And it brings up ideas and thoughts about character building that go into this line of work. Maybe not so much the therapeutic kind, but what is it about Miss Cleo that draws people to her?
You know, she describes herself as a big mama, and I think people just really need that nurturing. People need to know that they're being listened to. You know, Miss Cleo, she was definitely, they had sort of shaped her in these infomercials to be someone who, she says in the film, just wasn't necessarily her. She has very strong beliefs. You know, her spirituality is very important to her. But ultimately, she was a mouthpiece for an organization that was getting people to call in and get their 5 free minutes of psychic readings. But as you saw in the film, she's very charismatic. She's someone you want to spend time with. And I think through the film, people get a chance to know Miss Cleo beyond just the call me now that was represented on TV.
Now, whether we're talking about Miss Cleo or the you know, the prevention workers or phone sex workers, it seems like a common theme is everybody has a story, if you've worked in this line, that's going to stick with you forever. Does this change the lives of the people who provide these various services?
You know, I do think so. I think that, you know, from a personal experience, I'm not featured in the film, but it really drove me working as a telephone psychic for just 6 weeks so I could fix my car, but then moving on into the suicide prevention hotline, I felt like I miss it to this day. Like, it's something that I crave. I want to help people, and I think that through this film, I'm able to tell my story through the stories of all these very intriguing and interesting people who sort of take us on their journey in a very thoughtful and provocative way.
Now, here we are in the age of Facebook and Twitter and texting. Do you still see there being this allure to this kind of work, people calling hotlines, people wanting to answer the call to connect with, you know, a human voice, just to talk, even though we have all these other means of communications now?
Well, you know, for so many members of marginalized communities out there, they're not able to find a community of their own, and I feel like hotlines are absolutely essential. I think that this film, by bringing awareness to hotlines and letting people know that it's important to reach out to those around them, I think that absolutely hotlines are essential, and I think that they will continue to be vital as a mode of communication. However, they might evolve. We're still using our phones. They're still on us. I think we're more connected to our phones more than ever.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Tony Schaff. His new documentary is called Hotline.